It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at witness intimidation in Milwaukee criminal cases and efforts to protect key witnesses.
First, technology has made our lives easier in lots of different ways. One of those ways is by tracking women's menstrual periods. Apps like Clue and Period Tracker allow women to put in data about their cycles and get push notifications about when they can expect their next period to start.
Our next guest says one of the unexpected consequences of these period tracker apps is that they're changing girls' culture. Because period tracking apps are so popular, menstrual cycles are losing their social stigma.
Ronnie Karen Rabin wrote about this topic for the New York Times, and she joins us now. She's a health writer for the New York Times. Ronnie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how do most of these period tracking apps work?
Well, you download them on your app, usually, and you're on your iPhone, and you start inputting data about the dates that you get your period. And after a few months, it can start giving you a prediction of sort based on your cycle, when you're going to get, if you want a reminder, when your period is due. It will tell you when it thinks you're ovulating and are fertile. And it will track all kinds of things, anything you really want to input, in, whether it's moods related to your period, what kind of birth control you're using, when you had sex, if you had unprotected sex, what kind of bloating or anxiety. One has literally an ABC of symptoms, acne, anxiety, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, fatigue, and goes on and on. So you can track anything you want, really. But a lot of people just want to be able to plan. It also will, you can put in, do you have heavy bleeding, do you have light bleeding, all kinds of information.
And these are things women might have tracked on a paper calendar if and when they remembered. This seems like it's going to be a lot easier to really stick with it from month to month.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's your phone, it's with you everywhere, and young women are using these phones all the time. They have them, they're used to using them. I think it's easier than a piece of paper, and it's also doing some calculations for you. And it's really keeping track over time, and it is using algorithms to give you feedback on it.
So who is using them? You said young women. So what is sort of the age bracket here?
You know, I don't know. It's a lot of women. I don't know that we have that clear data. There are over 200 of these apps, and they're being downloaded a lot. So I'm not sure I really know who's. There are different people using them. Different. Some have been actually were designed for fertility, for women who really are trying to get pregnant. And so they'll really highlight, they'll send you a message saying your flowers are blooming and highlight your fertile period. And one concern that some doctors have is whether women are going to rely on this for birth control. Now, some of the apps are trying to design a kind of family, what they call these cycles that can give you an indication of when you can avoid pregnancy. But as we know, these things aren't 100% reliable.
We're talking to Ronnie Karen Rabin from the New York Times. She's a health writer looking at new period tracking apps for women and the impact they might be having on the culture surrounding menstruation for younger women. So let's get to that part now, Ronnie. What are some of the signs that social stigma surrounding menstrual cycles might be going away related to these apps?
Well, some of it's in the apps. I think the apps give women legitimacy. This is kind of a hard data. We're turning this into words that, first of all, we're giving people language. Some women, you know, didn't grow up talking about this or feeling comfortable about it. So we have real clear words for things like spotting and heavy flow, and they have the tool to kind of track it and not feel embarrassed because it's a technology that's open, you know, that's out there, that's thinking about them. I think there are things going on in the larger culture as well, though. I mean, I think there are women writing songs about their period. Annie DeFranco has a song called Blood in the Boardroom. There's a video game called Tampon Run. This is going way beyond, and I think in Wisconsin there's been an effort to acknowledge that women need tampons and sanitary pads, and I think you're trying to put them in public buildings, and Canada lifted taxes off of these products, and I think there's a growing acknowledgement that this isn't something that people need to whisper about or be scared to talk about or ashamed or embarrassed about. This is kind of facts of life, and there's an effort here in New York City to make tampons available in some public schools. So, and also a move to try to lift taxes. So So there's kind of a whole, there are also these new eco-friendly sanitary products, which don't call themselves sanitary products. There's something called Sphinx, underwear for women with periods. And that's how they advertise, underwear for women with periods.
Interesting. So much going on. You know, it strikes me listening to you that, you know, when I was growing up, this would be something you talked about with your girlfriends, not really in the culture at large. And yet you talked to your own daughter and she sort of said, yeah, you can quote me in your article. No big deal. It's not embarrassing. That seems to signify kind of a big cultural shift.
Well, I think there is a cultural shift. I hope there is. I think we're more open about a lot of things, and we talk about TMI. I think we do. Technology has kind of given us permission to talk about things that we haven't. And girls today are very busy, and they're doing a lot of things. And a lot of girls are using this just for planning purposes. They just don't want to have to remember. They don't want to be caught by surprise. They want to make sure they're prepared. And this is helpful.
Ronnie, for men listening who maybe haven't heard those quiet conversations in the past, how huge is this change between the apps, this opening up, this decline in secrecy and stigma?
Well, I think it remains to be seen. I mean, I think we're still just, this is just starting out. I think there have been women who have called themselves menstrual activists for quite some time, trying to remove the taboo from this. I think boys and men are a big part of the picture. I mean, they still take the boys out from sex ed when they talk about the period, and they talk to them about something else. So I think we still have a lot of barriers to break down. And I think it's still something that a lot of men and boys will say, "Ick, I'm going to leave the room while you talk about this." So I think we have a ways to go.
Well, privacy is a concern with a lot of apps. What kinds of privacy concerns do period tracking app users worry about, if they do?
Well, there's actually two levels of concerns. One is that, as you know, your data is being tracked and mined and crushed and crunched, and every app has a different privacy policy. And at first I was concerned people wouldn't read them, but even if you read them, you're not necessarily going to understand them. A lot of them the language is very confusing. Suffice it to say, a lot of this data is de-identified data of yours will be used maybe for research, for really good research, but it's going to go somewhere, a lot of it. So you need to be aware of that. And the other thing I think people need to be aware of, it's on your phone. If your phone isn't locked, or if your ex-boyfriend knows your girlfriend knows your password, there's sensitive information in there. If you put in, as a lot of people are going to put in when they had sex and track, you know, if they want to make sure they're not pregnant. So there's going to be sensitive information that's de-identified, but also that could be identified.
You talked to some women who have used these apps, including, as Veronica mentioned, your daughter. Is that a worry that they have? Is this something that might stop them from entering all the information they could possibly add?
I just want them to think about it. I do think most of it is being used in a de-identified way. Might they still get marketing messages? Possibly, depending on the app. I think it is a concern. And I think it's a concern. It's not just a concern for this. It's a concern for a lot of health apps and for the information we seek on the web. We're being tracked in many ways all the time. So it's something we need to think about all the time.
Ronnie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Ronnie Kieran-Rabin is a health writer for the New York Times. She was with us to talk about how period tracking apps are changing the social stigma around menstrual cycles.
Early this month, Milwaukee police and prosecutors nearly prevented the murder of a key witness in a homicide case, with the crime allegedly plotted by the murder suspect himself while behind bars working with accomplices outside of jail.
It's just one example of an ongoing problem with witness intimidation in Milwaukee, with key witnesses in criminal cases subject to threats, bribery, and violence, often in cases related to homicide or domestic violence. Police and prosecutors kicked off a new effort to protect those witnesses after the high-profile murder of a witness in 2007.
John Diedrich joins us now. He's been reporting on this issue for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How big a problem is witness intimidation there in Milwaukee?
Well, it's a major problem. You alluded to this case, the Pulley case in 2007. This individual was shot himself, and he was cooperating. He was a victim witness, cooperating in the prosecution of the individual who shot him. That individual offered him money, increasingly more money, or through surrogates, and ultimately Mr. Pulley continued to persist in his desire to testify, and then he ultimately was murdered, shot a second time, this time fatally. And when that happened, John Chisholm, the county board and other official state officials as well, gathered together and said, you know, this issue has to be taken on. This has to be more thoroughly investigated, more aggressively investigated. And the problem hasn't gone away, but prosecution has certainly stepped way up here in Milwaukee County.
What did police and prosecutors do after 2007, after that death of Maurice Pulley Jr., to try to make sure they could protect witnesses?
Well, what they do is they look at cases where they have a good idea that intimidation may be a factor. You alluded to domestic violence, and the nature of domestic violence is intimidation, really, in the original offense. So it turns out that that's a prime target where intimidation may happen after the initial offense. There's a saying in court that says, no face, no case. And so if you can keep the witness out of court or intimidated, the charges may go away. So that was one area that they really focused on. And they beefed up the number of investigators there. But then they also started looking at cases, high-profile cases, where individuals had a lot riding on the line in terms of shooting cases or other cases where long prison sentences were possibly waiting. And they started to look for different patterns, individuals who've been through the system before, who've been able to, where cases were dismissed because witnesses failed to show at key moments and so forth. And they started to develop a protocol in which they could try to figure out how, which cases would be most likely. And their biggest tool that they use is monitoring jail calls and figuring out different ways that they can, also working with, the investigators, but trying to figure out where witness intimidation may happen and aggressively investigated.
And then when they think that there may be witness intimidation, a possible threat against a witness, are there ways to protect them, to remove them from, at least to as much as possible, remove them from risk?
Well, there is that aspect. It's interesting, prior to this effort, that was exclusively the witness protection program, in that individuals were moved to hotels or different places to protect them from immediate risk. And that effort still continues. The problem with that effort alone was that it really didn't hold the offenders accountable for their actions. Ultimately it was an expensive effort that did protect individuals, but it did nothing to hold the cases accountable. And also the cases sort of blew up after a while, because even if you protected them, at some point witnesses might disappear. But that protection effort continues, but now it's coupled with aggressive investigation by the investigators with the District Attorney's Office in Milwaukee County.
Talking to John Diedrich, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about a piece he wrote on witness intimidation in Milwaukee and efforts to protect key witnesses in criminal cases, often, as he says, in cases of shootings or domestic violence. Now, I started this off, John, talking about this attempt to kill a witness, a conspiracy, in effect, to kill a witness that fell apart earlier this month, in part thanks to the efforts you've been describing. It's a crazy story, could have been in movies almost. Can you talk us through this story?
Yeah, it is quite a remarkable story. So the story starts over summer. There's an individual, Eddie Powell, who is killed in a shooting. An individual is charged in that shooting, and he is he's charged and detained immediately, Anthony Smith. Shortly after that shooting, one of the witnesses to that shooting, 8 days later, is shot and killed. That shooting remains unsolved at this point. But what happens after that is that there's a second witness to this shooting, John Spivey. John Spivey is in jail on a different case. And what happens is Anthony Smith, who's charged with the original homicide, conspires allegedly with three other individuals to get to Spivey, to bail him out of jail, pay his bail, and they're waiting outside the jail with the intention of grabbing him and taking him to, as the district attorney, presumably for great bodily harm or death. And this plot is discovered prior to his release, and the district attorney investigators sort of swoop him up, move him to a secure location, and then really turn the table on the individuals who are plotting this particular act of violence.
So now, in addition to the original alleged perpetrator of the shooting, now there are cases against the three people conspiring with him to remove, to kill this witness in his case.
That's right, and that's the way these things are sort of unfolding. And as the investigators and as the district attorney, John Chisholm, explained, really what witness intimidation represents is the continuation of the investigation. So, you know, sort of in the older way of thinking, it was you brought the charges and then that was sort of a stop. And really this is keeping up with the defendants who are seeing that, you know, eliminating witnesses, so that will be the sort of key. And so the way the system is responding is, all right, there's going to be new cases, additional cases that may come. It's the continuation of that. So in this case, Smith has a new charge, but now there's three more individuals who are alleged to be conspiring to commit first-degree intentional homicide.
Is there a hope that this effort to crack down on witness intimidation will help deter it, will help people say, hey, sorry, you're in jail, we're not going to help you try to silence the witnesses?
Well, I mean, that's the hope. You know, my reporting reveals that there's a whole lot of witness intimidation going on, and this isn't just in Milwaukee. I'm hearing from folks around the state and in other cities, certainly. But it's brazen in the courthouse. It doesn't appear to be abating. I mean, at this point in the galleries, you know, you have individuals who are, you know, obviously defying court orders and they're being removed, but they're acting very defiant toward you know, armed sheriff's deputies. You have them you know, making comments, you know, muttering expletives as prosecutors come and go from court. You know, I was talking to a prosecutor who said that it's really almost in every single case that they're dealing with. Another prosecutor said it's really you know, out of control. Now that said, what they think this effort is doing is, number one goal is to prevent these cases from getting blown up, to basically save them from being undercut, because this is really what the basis of the criminal justice system is about, that, you know, that there be a fair trial and that witnesses not be intimidated, they feel free and open to come to court. So they're trying to protect the cases. And, you know, I guess their sense is that, you know, they hope over time that this message, you know, will get out, though just looking at the number of cases that they continue to bring. I mean, in 2009, we were looking at 147 cases, and this year we're going to be over 400 cases of just witness intimidation, and the numbers just continue to go up. So I think their hope is that the message will get out, but it does not, the tide has not been stemmed at this point.
That being the case, though, you quote someone from a police department elsewhere in the country saying people are starting to look at what they're doing in Milwaukee as a model for trying to tackle the problem of witness intimidation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's this interesting story where the problem really is, according to the folks in the system, out of control, but the efforts here are a national leader. So both of those things can be true. And what that indicates is that what Milwaukee's doing is, again, this continuation of the criminal investigation, really creating a second case that goes on top of the first case. And that is, according to folks out there, experts who are saying this is really one of the futures of law enforcement, because it holds an individual accountable through the judicial system and helps keep the integrity in it. But what's happening, according to folks out there, is that there's really a whole lot of this problem in cities across the country where they haven't caught up to the necessity to really address this witness intimidation head on with an aggressive effort that tries to get ahead using, you know, sophisticated techniques to try to predict when jail calls might be made that, you know, that could have incriminating information on social media postings that could include intimidation, all sorts of manners of ways that intimidation is communicated. And I suspect we're going to see those efforts step up in other places, looking to Milwaukee's possible model.
Briefly, as we wrap up, John, are prosecutors saying, yeah, there's still work to do, but we have cases where we've successfully prosecuted guilty individuals because of our efforts to protect these witnesses?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the sense of success that they have is that this is absolutely protecting cases. We're seeing a big bounce in the number of domestic violence cases, holding those offenders accountable. No, they feel like they really are bringing justice to these cases and protecting the integrity of these cases and protecting their witnesses, and they hope sending a message. But the numbers continue to go up, and we'll see in the long term how effective their efforts are.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's John Diedrich, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, where he covers crime and other issues, talking about his recent coverage of witness intimidation. Authorities in Chicago announced today they will charge a police officer with first-degree murder in the shooting death of a 17-year-old African-American man. Tomorrow, the city will release a video of the shooting, footage that authorities worry will lead to protests.
Last night, five people were shot in Minneapolis outside a police precinct where protesters had gathered for over a week after the police shooting of Jamar Clark. Police shot and killed the young, unarmed African-American man after a struggle with officers following his interference with paramedics who were trying to help an assault victim.
And today is the one-year anniversary of a Missouri grand jury's decision to not charge a police officer for the shooting death of an unarmed black teen in Ferguson. There have been several other high-profile cases. In Baltimore, Freddie Gray died in police custody. A reserve deputy in Oklahoma shot and killed an unarmed black man. And here in Wisconsin, there have been protests over the police-involved shootings of Tony Robinson in Madison and Dontre Hamilton in Milwaukee.
Chad Dion Lassiter is here to talk about the relationships between police and African-American communities and protests like the Black Matter movement, Black Lives Matter movement. Chad Dion Lassiter is a national expert on race relations and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Good evening, and thank you for having me.
Well, take us back, if you would, to a year ago when the grand jury in Missouri announced that they wouldn't press charges against the officer who shot and killed Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager. What happened?
Well, I think the grand jury got it wrong. I think when you look at what happened to happened in Ferguson, just the trauma that existed in that community, given the context of the death of Michael Brown. Once again, we don't want to say all police officers, but I think we learned a lot from Ferguson with regards to the Department of Justice report. I think we also understand fundamentally that we have to get these type of cases out of the hands of regular grand jurors, but we need to put it in the hands of an independent federal prosecutor where there can potentially be some equity. And when we also look at some of the challenges that we're seeing now is that we still continue to see this anthology of police brutality by some police officers vis-a-vis black males, which just continues to be alarming.
And this movement was a pivotal one for the Black Lives Matter movement. It had started before Ferguson, going back to the Trayvon Martin shooting. But a year ago in Ferguson, what was the Black Lives Matter movement like then?
Well, I think it was just now getting to formulate and conceptualize how it was going to approach the killing of black males with impunity by the state. I think there seems to be some misconceptions about the Black Lives Matter movement in the sense that some want to say that it's radical, that it calls for the killing and the harming of police officers. But let's make no mistake, the Black Lives Matter movement is a coalition of not just black individuals, but also white individuals and others who are standing up to simply say, let's look at some of the challenges that are happening in our democracy vis-a-vis police officers and the African-American community, and for that matter, communities of color in general.
And how do you see that Black Lives Matter movement changing since Ferguson a year ago?
I see them actually getting more individuals involved. I would imagine that some of the challenges we saw in Oklahoma with students uniting against the racist chant on the bus by the fraternity, what's happening in Missouri, the students who are doing sit-ins and civil disobedience protests at Princeton University and all over the country, I think the Black Lives Matter movement has served as a catalyst for individuals and specifically students to find their voice within the confines of some aspects of structural inequality. I think that it's amazing that students on all sides of the color line and gender line are standing up and speaking back to the powers that be.
And in terms of reaching real recognizable benchmarks, how effective has it been?
Well, I don't have any qualitative and quantitative data as a social scientist and researcher to speak to that aspect of things. One of the things I do know is that aspects of the Black Lives Matter movement have met with Bernie Sanders. They have met with Hillary Clinton and others. But I do want to say that there is a current in the country where young people on all sides of the color line and gender line are speaking up. You see students in China who are saying Black Lives Matter. In Brazil, Black Lives Matter. There was a student protest at a high school in Berkeley, California. 2,000 white students came out of the school and they did a protest, Black Lives Matter. And so in our democracy, when we say, well, no, all lives matter, Black Lives Matter is just a political rallying cry that simply says Black Lives Matter in the midst of, you know, white supremacy shootings and killings by some police officers. We've always known that all lives matter. But in our democracy, we know from three-fifths, from slavery to Jim Crow to chattel slavery in this present time of the new Jim Crow, that black lives have not mattered. And sometimes they haven't mattered to even black people vis-a-vis some of the violence that we see and the intra-conflicts in our urban areas.
The University of Pennsylvania's Chad Dion Lassiter is with us now to talk about the Black Lives Matter movement 1 year after a grand jury decided not to indict the officer involved in the shooting death of black teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And since that time, there have been several more high-profile fatal shootings of young African-American men by police officers over the last year. And just in recent months, we've been hearing again in stories out of Minneapolis, stories out of Chicago. How have these shootings affected the cities and communities where they happen, and has anything unfolded differently since Ferguson?
I think what we've seen is we've seen a wider divide with regards to the trust versus mistrust. I always like to look at these things from a mental health perspective. We're always talking about how these communities can get back to a sense of normalcy, but we don't actually talk about how we can deploy social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, nurses, trauma counselors to deal with the trauma of, one, the individuals who have lost their loved one, i.e. black mothers, black fathers, the black community, brown communities. And we also don't talk about how those young people will not be in the classroom with some of their classmates, i.e. Mike Brown, Jordan Davis, you know, and the list just goes on and on. I think what we've also seen is we've seen an increase of tension, because now there are times where we're starting to paint all police officers the same. And there are a lot of police officers who put their lives on the line every day for humanity, not knowing if they're going to come back home to their respective families or to their respective communities. And so we see a lot of those challenges. But we know that there are still some gross inequalities in Baltimore. We see it in Ferguson. It's in Chicago. It's in Philadelphia. It's in Detroit. And so we really have to look at all these things that lead to some of these challenges in the community: economic violence, educational inequality, a lost economy, hopelessness, despair, and also institutional racism.
Would you say that the trust between some African-American communities and some police departments has gotten more intense, the trust issues, I should say, or is it still a problem that's maybe getting worse before it gets better?
Great question. I think it's actually getting worse. But this is not anything that's new. Earlier when I talked about the anthology of police brutality, you can go back to the 50s where individuals were just simply trying to go to school or sit at a Woolworth counter or get on a bus. And that's where you get the institutional racism from, because it was prejudice plus power that led to the institutional policy that said you can't come to this library, only whites can, or you have to go to that water fountain that says colored only. And so some of these children came up hearing those narratives, and they see those narratives maybe from a family member who shows them the eye on the prize, and white students of consciousness have also heard from their grandmothers and their grandfathers of how they were freedom riders, where you had German shepherds biting the breasts of women, to this era that we're in where black males are having their hands up and they're still being killed. What is it about the psyche of some white police officers where they see black males as the boogeymen, or they see them as intimidating, where you're not shooting to just simply maim, but you're shooting to kill, and you're unloading and you're reloading. And so that becomes problematic. And so, yes, there is a challenge around trust versus mistrust. Some communities are trying to, you know, get in front of community policing. They're starting to hold town halls and forums where they can talk about the issues of trust versus mistrust on all sides. We don't want to say all police officers, but we also want police officers to not look at all black males as from a criminality standpoint.
So you mentioned the relationship that has to happen, that's evolving between some police departments, some African-American communities, and also these structural issues of racial inequality a year out from Ferguson again today. Is this an evolving story? Has any progress been made?
Some progress has been made, but I think the biggest challenge is what we're seeing now is this whole aspect of white racial consciousness and white anxiety from some whites that America pretty soon is going to be brown, and that whites are going to be in the minority. And so I think there's some psychological outfalling and outpouring of just some disdain around that when you hear some of the rhetoric that you witness and you see firsthand from Donald Trump. And we think that he's a mere sideshow, but Donald Trump needs to be taken seriously because he can, in fact, end up being the president of the United States, as homophobic, as xenophobic, and as insensitive that he is. But I think one of the things that we need to really look at is we need to have a frank conversation about structural inequality. We need not look at, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement as a movement that is threatening. They're not like the Tea Party. They're not like the Ku Klux Klan. No one from the Black Lives Matter movement has desecrated a synagogue or a church, burned a cross. We do know that we've had some uprisings, but that has not been the individuals from the Black Lives Matter movement. That have been individuals in Ferguson and Baltimore who have been fed up with the structural inequality and some of the tension. So we have to do a better job in the mental health profession and just as a society to say we don't want people dumping that anger out on property or on personhood. But the question that we have to ask ourselves Socratically is what do people do with that pain and frustration? We want them to do something constructively, but King himself said that riots are the language of the unheard.
We're talking right now to national race relations expert Chandian Lassiter, talking about the Black Lives Matter movement on the one-year anniversary of the announcement that no charges would be filed against a police officer who shot an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri.
We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think about what you've seen from the Black Lives Matter movement? Have you participated in maybe a recent protest on racial equality issues? What do you think that police departments around the country could do to help rebuild trust between officers and minority communities? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now with University of Pennsylvania professor Chandian Lassiter about the Black Lives Matter movement.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about Black Lives Matter? Are you part of Black Lives Matter? Have you participated in protests or seen them? What do you think about this, and what do you think needs to change when it comes to issues of racial inequalities in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Callers now. We have Amy with us in Milwaukee. Amy, hi.
Hi. Last week I was at the holiday tree lighting in Milwaukee at Red Arrow Park, where they were supposed to be holding a vigil at the same time as the tree lighting for Dontre Hamilton. It ended up in a full-blown, you know, protest. And there were children, you know, singing Christmas carols that they had been practicing for weeks. And these Black Lives Matter, these Black Lives Matter people were, you know, throwing, you know, a huge protest. Like, it wasn't the right time, and I think it makes their organization look just, you know, not very civilized.
Amy, thank you so much for calling with your thoughts about the incident that happened in Milwaukee at a tree lighting ceremony. And I realize on the other side of that matter, there were those who said that maybe that park was no longer the appropriate place for a celebration like that, having been a death so recently. But Chad Dion Lassiter, what do you say to situations like that that I'm sure will continue to happen?
Well, I respect the caller. And, you know, just from her vantage point, how she viewed it. But it's interesting that she used the word linguistically, made them look like they weren't civilized. Maybe she doesn't recognize this, but in the larger scope of things in our society, it's always amazing how we deem some civilized versus uncivilized, human versus subhuman. Maybe the park served as a metaphor for individuals who recognized that a life was lost at that park. And maybe this wasn't a time to be singing Christmas carols, that everything is not jubilee, everything is not, you know, touchy-feely, tiptoe through the tulips and, you know, a wonderful time. Let's celebrate Christmas. There's a lot of pain that still exists. Michael Brown's mother has pain. Jordan Grant's mother has pain. Jordan Davis' mother, excuse me, and Oscar Grant's mother, and all these mothers and fathers and communities have pain. I don't want us to get so caught up in just looking at this from a Black Lives Matter perspective, because when we say Black Lives Matter, it denotes that it's just Black people fighting for equality. There are white people who are part of this Humanity Matters movement that is addressing Black lives being killed by the state and sanctioned by the state, by some white police officers killing Black males. We're not asking for the killing of white males, but we do not see white males losing their lives in our democracy at the hands of white police officers or Black police officers. And when white males do engage in, you know, criminal behaviors and school shootings, or Dylan Ruth, who walks into a church and massacres 9 people, we're looking at it from a biopsychosocial perspective, where Black males are seen as the problem.
And Chad, earlier before we went to the break, you were talking about some of your concerns about what to do with the emotional health issues that are arising mm-hmm. from some of these scenarios we're talking about, anger and fear. And you mentioned yourself that on the one hand, you have police officers and departments feeling embattled right now. And on the other hand, members of the African-American community feeling expendable and targeted. So how does one, as a society, I guess, deal with those issues that arise at that juncture between those two?
Well, you all know I've been on your show several times over the past 5 years, and I'm not going to use this opportunity to placate, ingratiate, or display with false generosity as if I know the answer to that, because I don't. One of the things I would suggest is that the police departments in our urban areas, suburban and rural areas, begin to embark upon anti-racism training. Cops need to look at male privilege. Communities need to also recognize that they can't have it both ways. You can't say that you disrespect the police or you don't trust the police, but yet you want to also call the police when you're in danger. I think we have to have communications. I think that we have to look at the hyper-masculinity that exists between some police officers and some people in the community, specifically males of color and police officers who are not of color. I think we also have to ask ourselves, who polices the police? And so they maintain a blue wall of silence of the status quo oftentimes. And you have white police officers who do want to come forward and say, hey, listen, my partner planted those drugs, but he also has to think about what happens when he goes out into the community with that same partner. You have Black police officers who I want to ask them a question directly. How do you feel about Black males being gunned down by white police officers when more often than not they've been found with no weapon? We've yet to hear that, and I think that is one of the things that adds to the fragmentation in our communities.
We're talking right now to the University of Pennsylvania's Chad Dion Lassiter, talking about the Black Lives Matter movement 1 year after a grand jury decided not to indict the officer involved in the shooting death of Black teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And we'll go back to our phones now. We have Lori with us in Stevens Point. Lori, hi.
Hi, good evening. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good evening.
I really, really enjoy listening to your insight. I would like to address, you know, I believe it comes down to training with our officers. At some point, there's been a shift because it does seem more of a militarized training aspect. And I guess maybe I come from a generation that saw police officers as someone who's supposed to come onto the scene and you know, be the voice of reason. And we all know from seeing the videos of all of these victims in the last year, we all see what's happened. We all saw the hands were up. The gentleman maybe was walking away or was exercising his rights verbally to the officer saying, no, you cannot do this to me. And you have to wonder if maybe it's time to put two cops in the cars now so that there's the balance. And I don't know if there's annual training or semi-annual training for officers to pass psychological tests or how are they doing. It's an extremely stressful job. Officers are necessary in our society. But I have to wonder, when you're dealing with so much of a lot of unpleasant things in life, what toll that takes. And maybe it's time to get out of the car and go into the office or, you know, is there a rotation? I really, truly believe that it comes down to training.
All right. Thank you so much for your thoughts, Lori. Chad, what do you say?
I think the caller is remarkable. I wish I could jump through the phone and, with her permission, high-five her and hug her, because she's absolutely right. Police officers deal with post-traumatic stress disorder as well. They deal with fear. Sometimes they're dealing with challenges that they may have at home, and there's a countertransference that happens while they're out in the street. I think they go oftentimes without debriefing about some of the horrific and horrible situations and deplorable situations that they sometimes walk into. I have a colleague here in Philadelphia who's a police officer who one time went in the house and talked about how the baby was a newborn and had maggots all over her body. And so they see a lot of things. So I think there is the training. I think there is the briefing. And I think that we have to look at the racial stereotypes that exist. When we look at Ferguson as a case study, Darren Wilson said that, you know, Mike Brown was coming to him and he looked like the Incredible Hulk. That's almost similar to saying he looked like King Kong, deeply rooted in The Birth of a Nation with D.W. Griffith, where black males were brute. Okay, but Darren Wilson was 6'4". He has the gun, he has the badge, and he has the authority on his side. But yet, he's scared. So you buy into that narrative. When these police officers are killing people like Walter Scott down in Charleston, South Carolina, and I think all black people are, you know, just simply saying, is give us the benefit of the doubt. Eric Garner, if he committed a crime by selling Lucy cigarettes, arrest him. If he didn't want to be arrested, then bring someone on the scene that can talk to him. But don't kill him, because that's trauma looking at that video. Dylan Ruth killed 9 people. He walks out in handcuffs. Ted Bundy, the Unabomber, so forth and so on. Sean Bell, he gets ran over by a police officer vehicle. And the only thing we talk about was he was at a strip club the night before his wedding. And so it just has to be equity on all sides. It's not all police officers, but we also need to say it's not all black males and it's not all males of color.
And just briefly, as we wrap up here, where do you see this movement going next and the American conversation about police and minority communities?
I don't know where the Black Lives Matter movement is going next. I think our democracy has an opportunity at this very moment to turn it into a movement where on all sides of the color line and gender line, we have a frank conversation about not being homophobic, not being transphobic, not engaging in irrational hatred. I think that we need to express how we may have a dislike for something. And maybe it's because we're xenophobic, but not a disdain that leads to irrational hatred. I wish that more people recognize and fundamentally understand that the Black Lives Matter movement is also comprised of white students and white individuals who are concerned for black humanity as well.
Chad, thank you so much for joining us.
As always, thank you for having me.
That was Chad Dion Lassiter, national expert on race relations and professor at the University of Pennsylvania.